You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
I've known Erica for several years now. We're both students together at Stanford in the Department of Communication. I've known her and her work for a long time, and it's been great to actually watch this sort of, I think when I first met you, you were more doing almost experimental psych work with NASS and people in the media lab at Stanford. But it's been just fascinating to watch this sort of transformation and this sort of progression of really being grounded in sort of a deep understanding of technical culture and how systems are built and how people understand systems, but to watch this sort of this contextualization of it in terms of people's spirituality and megachurch practices in particular. So I think that's what we're going to speak about today. So Eric is coming from NYU from the Media, Culture, and Communication program. Take it away, Eric.
Well, so I'm delighted to be here, and I'll try to keep my remarks to about 30 minutes. Feel free, if you've got questions or things like that, to, you know, throw up a hand. I'm pretty excited to have a bit of a discussion, so I'll try to maintain a lot of time for this. And today I'm going to talk about some work that I've been doing for maybe like 5 or 6 years now. I'm sort of at the book wrapping up place with this project. And as Mike mentioned, my initial training was actually in like experimental psychology. So, and before that in computer science. So this is a long way away from what I thought I might be doing when I grew up, I guess. But at the same level, maybe it's part of the same shared tradition, which is to say I've been quite curious for a very long time about how people know that they're up to the same thing, how we experience ourselves as part of a collective life, and what kinds of traditional cultural institutions or architectural formations or technologies enable that sensibility to preserve as we go through various kinds of change. So today I'm going to talk about a particular institution that's been in the news quite a lot lately, it turns out. They've recently declared bankruptcy. So there's a certain sort of impending deadline here. But in any case, I just want to share with you some of the things I've been thinking about with respect to the role of religion in the American context, primarily with respect to taking up technological change. So in the last 30 or 40 years, there's been a radical shift in the landscape, especially in the religious landscape, especially in the sense of Protestantism. So I wanted to show a couple of pictures of these things that we sort of generally call megachurches, defined by being Protestant always, 2,000 plus people per service. They tend to look more like corporate campuses, office complexes. The vernacular architecture seems to be something which doesn't gesture towards traditional sacred meeting house spaces that would be common in the U.S., etc. The interiors tend to be very amphitheatrical, to use a lot of high-tech performative capabilities, lots of screens, extraordinary audio capacities, lots of Twitter, network capabilities, etc. Here's one of my favorites. This is the old Houston Rockets Stadium in Texas, capable of accommodating 12,000 worshipers per service. This is Joel Osteen's church. So these are a certain kind of way in which the church no longer looks like church. To give you a sense of the scope of megachurches, there's at least 1,600 documented in the United States alone, which if you do the math means over 6 million Americans are going to one of these a week. And so even though it's actually a relatively small number of the total churches, it commands an extraordinary amount of resources financially and in terms of human, you know, power. So the question at some level is, okay, so why should we be thinking with these when we think about new media technologies? Is this a sense of appropriation and largesse, maybe a kind of spectacular cathedralization of religious practices in the Protestant world, or something else perhaps going on that might be useful to thinking about how to keep society together? So this is the Crystal Cathedral, which is the group I'll be concentrating on today. So I came to the Crystal Cathedral, I'm just going to get up for a second and do this sort of reading of the space, in part because the model of public life was so extraordinary. There's about 3,000 people in this sanctuary. This is the fifth largest pipe organ in the world. There is, in fact, a preacher up here on the altar. You can see him in this interpersonal framing on the Sony Jumbotron plasma screen, which is about 60 feet. This is the first indoor installation before any sports arena of a screen this big. The whole building is about 12 stories tall. It's glass, so there's an extraordinary amount of transparency built into the aesthetics of a space like this. And these doors at the back are 9 stories tall. They open completely. They refer to them as the Cape Canaveral doors. And so there's a lot of the gesture of breaking down the barriers between inside and outside spaces, sacred and profane, being very visible. This space is also a very uncanny denomination to be engaged in this kind of spectacular practice. The Crystal Cathedral is part of the Reformed Church in America, which comes from the Dutch Reformed. This is like Calvin's church. The oldest Protestant denomination in the Americas, founded with New Amsterdam in 1628. So these are not the folks that you would generally expect to be doing this kind of extraordinary media work. And so they pose a kind of puzzle. They're both very public in very complex ways. I should mention they also had the first nationwide television broadcast of church service in the U.S., which is still the fourth longest running program on the air today. It's called The Hour of Power. And so I want to understand a little bit about what makes this place seem like a logical extension of spiritual practice. And I'm going to talk today about one strand of that transformation through the architectural works themselves. So this space, the Crystal Cathedral, is a beautiful natural experiment because it's gone through a number of iterations. It started in the post-war era as a drive-in theater church, which is uncanny in a sense, but then managed to parlay that expertise with automobiles and roadside cinema into a way of making modern architecture to become a walk-in, drive-in television church. So I'm going to talk about that, what it means to move from the cinematic to this other model of multiple spatial boundary. And then I want to argue that we could look back at the Crystal Cathedral and see in the model of space that I just showed an emblem of mediated congregation, a way of being together as a collective experience in increasingly mobile, distributed, mediated social conditions. And that might be a good place to take the discussion. So I'm going to walk through these three examples for a second, just the architectural thread. To give a sense of the place that this is happening, this is Orange County, California. For those of you who know that area well, the Crystal Cathedral is located about 3 miles from Disneyland, so it's really the heart of Orange County. And when they got started in 1955, it was not sprawl. It was mostly an agrarian kind of place, lots of farming, orange groves, walnut groves, etc. When I started doing my research in 2006, so Google Map view, it looked more like this. So there's a way as well in which this kind of institution is a certain kind of portrait into a broader cultural geography shifting, and so some tensions being placed on the feeling of being together in very different kinds of conditions. I just want to frame that. All right, so talk a bit about the drive-in church, what it means to do this sort of appropriation. So this is 1957 at what is called at the time the Garden Grove Community Church. So are there folks in here familiar with drive-ins? At all? Okay, great. So I just want to give a few senses. They're spectacular and relatively smart. They were invented in the 1930s, but really hit their stride in the years after the war when America has a certain kind of fascination with everything automobilized. So the drive-in theater, this is a shot taken from a giant screen, which doesn't work during daylight hours, and then looking onto what is actually a congregation every Sunday. This is the concession stand where people could go get snacks during the performance, and so on the roof there is an altar, which we'll look at from a different point of view. Drive-ins are pretty great because they have these sort of like amphitheatrical arrangement of a parking lot, and then this undulating asphalt so that you're always slightly on a ramp. You can always see the main performance. And then you put these speaker boxes on your cars, and that's how you get the broadcast. So these are very popular right about the moment when cinema is becoming less the site for doing public life because television is on the rise. So they're sort of a stopgap measure in that moment of the domestication of leisure. So these are the founders of the drive. And this is Reverend Schuller and his lovely wife, Arvella, who are coming from the Midwest, which is generally where the Reformed religion is practiced, as missionaries for their denomination in the years after the war, when a lot of religious groups are looking to expand, particularly in the West. So the story is something as follows. You know, they're a small denomination, generally pretty Dutch, very insular, and so there really aren't any churches available for them to use, and they're having trouble locating a space for rent. And so they decide, you know, as all good entrepreneurs do, to scrawl a list of possibilities on a white paper napkin. And so they think about things like Elks Lodges, Masonic temples, public schools, empty buildings of all kinds. And none of them work out, right? So the story goes. Until, of course, the drive-in theater, which cannot be used on Sunday mornings because of the daylight, we don't have plasma screens yet, is available and for rent. So this is an interesting kind of historical accident of a sort. Generally, Protestant architectures require about one thing only, which is to say a nave, a kind of tent-like structure where you can all be together in community. But the drive-in theater requires that you find a way to be together in a bunch of tiny little enclaves. So there's something already at work in the spatial logics that demands a certain kind of design thinking and rationale. So what they do in order to extend this imagination of being together is a series of different kinds of infrastructural appropriations. Every Sunday, they start to repurpose the theater itself as something that does double duty. So you'll note here, the Orange Drive-In Theater, the swap meet, which is very common for large parking lot structures, meets Saturday and Sunday. But underneath it says, Sunday is today, featuring Robert Schuller and his supporting cast of thousands. And the other illustration on the left says Gidget, right, is playing as a double header with the drive-in church. So there's always this marquee that can be like a double feature for secular and sacred purposes. That concession stand becomes an altar. This piece, this cross on the back actually folds down and pops up once a week. So there's a sense that there's a separation of time that's called out on Sunday mornings, right? And maybe my favorite is the repurposing of the speaker box on the lip of the car, which is actually worked into the announcement for the services themselves. So I would refer to this as something like a technological rubric. Rubrics are traditionally that red ink on, next to the black ink, and like a, when you go to like a Catholic mass or something, that tells you like when to bend your knee and pray, what to do, the call and response. In this case, the speaker box becomes one of these things that's placed into the rubric. So you might be told something in the morning's pamphlet, like welcome to worship in the drive-in theater, please remove the speaker, place it in your car, adjust the volume, pray that God may bless the hour you spend here, participate, etc. And then after benediction, caution, be sure the speaker is returned to the rack before you drive away from the park stand, right? So in a way, these little tiny appropriations that are letting the church stitch a new set of meanings on top of an already very familiar set of ritual practices for a collective life in suburbia, just secular ones, right? So you do this every week and it sort of slowly gets into your body in interesting ways. The group also works very hard to position the church as something particular. So they always refer to the drive-in church not as something inadvertent, but as actually the beautiful drive-in church, right? Which, where you can worship in the shadows of rising mountains surrounded by colorful orange groves and tall eucalyptus trees. You can come as you are in the family car. Right? So there's an imagination already in place here about the way you would want to do collective life that is privatized and accessed. You don't have to, you know, you can extend domestic space into other places and be together while being at some level a little bit alone. So in addition, the group's very savvy about back constructing a genealogy that makes them look legitimate to the denomination. So the person who's taken over the head of the Reformed Church in the early 1950s is a guy called Norman Vincent Peale, who some of you may be familiar with. He's sort of, if you've ever been to your dentist's office and seen a guideposts, you know, waiting for you, that's him. He wrote The Power of Positive Thinking, which sort of inaugurates self-help literature in American culture writ large. I mean, he's kind of like Freud. Like, you don't even know you've read him, but you've read him if you grew up in this country. And so Peale is a pop culture celebrity. There are, like, Hallmark cards about this guy in the 1950s. And so what Reverend Schuller does is invite Peale to come speak. He becomes the first of many celebrity speakers in this space. But he's the ideal person to say, look, we can be both within the main line of our denomination and have complete street cred, right? Like, he's popular. And so it's a way of bridging and brokering these worlds together in interesting ways. So it's a little bit about the production. I'll say a few words about why this is a legible arrangement or desirable to folks, these neo-suburbanites in the 1950s. In part, I've mentioned this is like the era of the automobile. So this is a Rainer Banham, the architectural historian and critic, this is a Rainer Banham quote. The full quote is, like earlier generations of English intellectuals learned Italian in order to read Dante in the original, I learned to drive in order to read Los Angeles in the original. Right? So it's a place of flow where the forms that are monumental are strictly visible through the cinematic architectures of the automobile and the windshield. And so this is a place where people already get that you should be able to do things by car. So there's an opening in the semantic network. Like, you can go to restaurants in your car. You can go to the bank. This is where, you know, convenience stores are invented. And so church becomes one of the offerings available in this kind of landscape. Pulled together with that is this sort of moving culture of privatization as well. Leisure is becoming something that you no longer do as you did in the war era at the cinema. It's something you do in the home, right, where you have a domestic space, you're with your family, and you're together by looking through these tiny screens at national life. Such that, in a way, it's not that hard to understand why it would be possible to be in domestic enclaves, sharing a common view with a broadcast system that stitches together all of the cars, and to experience that as a sensibility of communitas. Okay. So I'll pause there for a second. All right, it's a little bit of fire hose. I'm very excited to have this conversation. And it's sort of a three-act play. It's got to have the parts, unfortunately, to be visible. So what I want to talk about is, like, this is a very uncanny thing. And there are a number of drive-in churches in this era, but this one's quite special because of the capacity to parlay this into new innovative architecture that's not quite done before. So I want to move to the 1960s and the walk-in drive-in television church. So by 1964, this is what the Garden Grove Community Church looks like. Radically, and you can see the cultural geography in the background is very different. You know, all this sprawl has moved in about 10 years in Orange County. Things have changed quite a lot. So this space was built by a guy called Richard Neutra, who I'll say a little bit more about. He's a modern architect of pretty high renown. And it's curious not only because, of course, it doesn't look like a church still, but also because it requires a putting together of multiple spatial orders. So if the drive-in cinema was something that already challenged the arrangement of a church, this challenges it threefold. There's still the amphitheatrical parking lot arrangement, but now there's all these folks sitting out on the lawn, and then there's this longitudinal sanctuary, and then there's this high-rise thing, which is topped, in fact, with a 90-foot blue neon cross, making it the highest point in Orange County, tied with the Matterhorn ride at Disneyland for a very long time. So this is, you know, churches don't do flexible corporate architecture. I mean, even now, right? So in the 1960s, this is a pretty radical proposition. And so figuring out how you move to something like this that's so complicated is, in a way, the linchpin of thinking about how you become eventually virtual, I would argue. So by the late 1950s, the drive-in church is pretty successful, and they're able to build a small stained glass chapel, but they never stop doing drive-in worship. So there's always, you know, the traditional space that's clearly signed as being distinct from profane, secular, everyday, mundane space by the stained glass and the cross and the interiority, and then also this drive-in thing they do right afterwards. And so they're always going back and forth between these two organizational forms. And at some point, of course, like all organizations, a certain sense of crisis ensues and some decisions need to be made about what direction to take. Do you take that missionary zeal and turn it into something that's a traditional church, or do you decide you want to incorporate the drive-in aspect of worship, which is a little uncanny, but very successful? So they decide they're going to put these together and make an indoor-outdoor church space. And in order to do that, they approach an architect called Richard Neutra, who I mentioned, who's very known for his indoor-outdoor work in California. So Neutra's actually originally trained in Austria, comes to the United States, and is one of the key brokers who brings an international European modernism to the American context. And then he moves to California to start doing these spaces that are, you know, quite different, I'll argue, than other modes of modernism. So this is a classic Neutra house from the 1950s. This is a shot taken from the couch, which I kind of love. So Neutra grew up playing with the Freud's children, which turns out to matter a bit. So he's sort of that Vienna, you know. So this is sort of architecture as therapy. Sylvia Levine, the architectural historian, has made a really wonderful argument about this kind of architecture being a bit different than the modern. So you can sit on your couch and experience this certain breakdown or blurring of the boundaries between the inside and the outside. So it's very unclear where the building ends, you know. And so he's using many techniques to make that happen. Does the building end here with the pool? Does it end with the glass wall? You can't even see the seam. There's actually a seam here of two glass walls coming together in order to complicate the notion that there's even a frame. Does it end where the spider legs that are steel infrastructure demarcate a boundary? Or is it all the way out on the horizon? Right? So there's always this feeling that you should be invited to think about the ways in which interiors and exteriors co-construct each other in order to, at some level, calm yourself down. Right? Sort of therapeutically, as an organism, engage in a certain kind of relationship with your setting. So they employ these kinds of characteristics at the church. And so Neutra brings his arsenal of indoor-outdoor techniques to do things like blur the boundaries. So here, I'll stay up maybe. This is the outside wall of the longitudinal sanctuary where there's this still pole running underneath and this cantilevered roof above so that you don't get the glare on the glass. That way you don't get reminded that there's actually a barrier there. And there's always this feeling of then being able to conflate the boundaries in a number of ways to problematize the distinction between multiple spatial arrangements. In addition, there's a folding of the ritual practice into the architectural extension. So this is the altar. So the minister ascends and then goes to the end, and it becomes what's known as the balcony of the word. He starts with the invocation of services by saying, you know, this is the day the Lord has made, let us give thanks and praise, and then pushes a button and a giant glass wall slides open, making the space totally continuous. So this is modernism as a mode of regulating flows, but not controlling them necessarily. And I'll show you another model of modernism in a second. So what you end up with
is a space where people get really, really good at not doing what other people are doing, but always being available as a performance to people next to them. So the people in the car can see the people on the lawn. The folks in the sanctuary are always aware of this peripheral vision. And so ritually, if there was a rubric before with the speaker box, this is the case of something like a performative gestalt, where we know we're doing something different, but we know we're all on the same page, and it's being enforced in the body over and over and over again. And so I think from that perspective, it becomes not that odd to think about this group being so keen to go on television, to begin to imagine that across a broadcast line, they could still be members of the same congregation, right? So there's an extension that's particularly spatial for this mediated imagination. All right, so I'm going to turn back and use that to situate what I think is going on with this Crystal Cathedral. So we started here with a sense of the church. This is the Crystal Cathedral is completed in about 1980, in part just because the walk-in drive-in church is sufficiently successful, especially once they start getting donations from television, that the space is overflowing. And so they need to do something. Neutra has passed away at this point, and so they enlist a different architect, Philip Johnson. So I mentioned Neutra is like pretty well known. Like, he's on the cover of Time magazine. You know, people know who he is. But Johnson is like famous, you know, in the 1970s. Philip Johnson is known for a lot of modern and postmodern buildings. He's the first director of architecture and design at the Museum of Modern Art. He is a broker of ways of thinking about architecture in America. He's a Harvard graduate, yeah. I'm sure that has nothing to do with it. But so I want to talk a little bit about the kind of space they asked for, why they might have asked for it, and how what he put together for them. So Schuller approached Johnson and asked precisely for a glass space. He said it was a way of thinking about his theology as something where there were no boundaries between people, right? Between you and your neighbor, so that horizontal sense of connection is fully open and apparent, and God can see you. So there's no vertical kind of boundary blocking others, right? So he had seen some of Johnson's outdoor pieces, but I think it might be useful to think about Johnson as an architect who was known for this kind of modern glass space. So this is Johnson's senior project here at the architecture school, and he completes it in 1949, and this is like one of the canonical pieces of American modern. This is the glass house. Right? It's a very different than a Neutra building. This is not a space of open flows and apertures. This is total visual control and uninterrupted spatial volume. So this would have been much more like a Protestant space where you could have a nave, right? We're all together under the same roof with no interruption. So something has happened here. And despite the fact that Neutra introduces this group to a way of thinking in complex ways about the boundaries between spaces, this is a kind of way of consolidating under one sign as totally transparent and available. Johnson is known by the late 1970s for moving from a modern world to a postmodern world. This is his AT&T corporate headquarters in New York. It's now the Sony building, which is compared often to a Chippendale armoire. So he's building skyscrapers, but he's doing precisely the kinds of hybrid pastiche things we associate with postmodernism as an aesthetic form, right? Blending things together. And so in a way that lets him have the kind of leverage to position this particular congregation inside of a new aesthetic regime. And he brings that to bear. So this is a sense of the Crystal Cathedral. It's this kind of star-shaped thing here, and this is the floor plan. It's essentially a pretty classically postmodern space. It's a cruciform building, so shaped like a cross, that's then been draped in what is more associated with corporate architecture, the curtain wall of glass. And then the seating inside, rather than moving along the longitudinal axis, is flipped 90 degrees like an amphitheater, so that you get this space where there are more people accommodated looking towards one of the sides. But it's a pretty recognizable maneuver. It's not that radical. However, from the perspective of the believers, when you get something like this, it functions therefore not so much as something that complicates or innovates architecturally as something that innovates symbolically and therefore consolidates a way of thinking about yourselves being together. So this space was erected at the cost of $21 million. Late 1970s, for those of you who recall / were, you know, reading papers by then, is kind of a time of, you know, spiraling economic inflation. They do this debt-free, right? $21 million in the late 1970s. This is a pretty remarkable thing. They do this not only by positioning Johnson as a way of showing to others, right? In a world where televangelism is now coming to the fore, that evangelicals are a latent network that can be gathered together and their wealth can become an accumulated collective good that stands together in a network of believers. But they also do it by therefore becoming what Durkheim referred to classically as an emblem of sociality. So everybody bought a window or a piece of iron pillar, and there's all kinds of quotes from the Bible to kind of legitimate this practice. So you can, for $500, own one of these pieces, and they will come together with pieces that other people own in order to create this structure. And then on top of this kind of emblematic sensibility of the power of evangelical Christianity, you will also receive a keepsake for your home, a small plaque or piece of glass so that you can remind yourself from the personal window that you're connected to something grand, right? So this is a kind of cathedral building ambition that signifies something to an audience worldwide. And so what that does is it creates a kind of hyper-visible mode of doing piety. So when you're in the Crystal Cathedral, there's a feeling that you are connected because your life is like a window. And Schuller says this in prayers, right? So your life becomes like a window to let God's light shine in and a mirror to reflect his glory into the world. It's a fully metaphorical sensibility. And so when you enter the space, you're not so much separated from the world as able to see it through new eyes. And you're always reminded at the same time that you're being seen by many people everywhere. So this is the HD screen. You'll often see shots like this that are exactly the same as what you're experiencing inside, but it's a way of reminding you that you're being framed in a model that is broadcast internationally, which has kind of a big effect. So much of the work being done here is that just by coming to the space and being an audience member, you're participating in some broader kind of imagination about congregation and its capacities, which can be repurposed into such things as national celebrations of belonging. So this is, you know, every 4th of July, et cetera, they actually lower the largest American flag in existence. And by the 1980s, that even becomes an imagination for what you can do internationally as Christians. So by 1989, 3 weeks before the fall of the Berlin Wall, the founder, Reverend Schuller, is on the air in Russia. This is Gorbachev visiting the cathedral. They're still the only Protestant broadcast in Russia today. And so it creates an imagination at every level that Christianity somehow is going to enable networks to cohere across the kinds of national lines that are breaking down. They're very early adopters, therefore, of the internet, Twitter. They're a pretty aggressive group, all said and done. So I want to pull back and make a few comments that might open this up for discussion. This is part of a larger book project for me that'll talk a lot more about the evangelical networks that open up the aesthetics of megachurches for a number of players in this group, and also that fold in things like the history of evangelicals on the internet and televangelism. But this is just, you know, so that'll all be called Mediating Eternity, I think. You know, I'm going for subtle. So here's some of the things I've been thinking about that I thought might be useful to talk with together. The first is that churches are sites we don't tend to think about much. In part, there's a certain kind of favoring for modern organizations, by which I mean things which are done by voluntary association. So markets, spheres, etc. And it might be worth thinking about whether or not there are kinds of belonging that involve a certain verticality in the imagination of being together, and how those kinds of imaginations might still play a very active role in shaping technological imaginations and modes of adopting. So churches become an interesting place to think about that turn towards a distributed form of social life in a very uncanny manner. Megachurches are particularly good examples of this because they are so high-tech. It's very hard to avoid how much they both don't look like church and yet how much they look recognizable to us. As an example, there are often no Bibles in these spaces. Like, the technology of, you know, the Protestant Reformation has been replaced by screens. Right, so on one hand, it might be a kind of banal shift, like, you know, what's the difference between flipping through your King James and doing it on a BlackBerry? I don't know, right? But it's definitely different when everybody's consolidating their vision towards a large Jumbotron plasma screen. That's a model of worship that Protestants tended to push against, you know, for a long time. So thinking about how these formal things shift might be useful, particularly in the megachurch context. In addition, we've tended to buy a story about secularization being tied up with technological progress. Like, the more media disrupts traditional kinds of space, the more we will do this voluntary association and see that there's not a traditional explanation that coheres as a way to be together. But actually, these groups are very compellingly mobilizing contemporary technologies precisely to replicate a mythic worldview. It's perfectly fine to continue to adopt the newest thing and a different kind of style in order to see God at work in everyday life. In part, I think that might be because rituals have always punctuated mundane uses of technical arrangements. So even if you use the same technology 6 days a week, on that seventh day, it becomes part of a different kind of exceptional process. And that calls out both a way to legitimate that technology and also something exceptional about being alive right there and then that frames meaning for people. And so it might be useful to think about these other kinds of exceptional uses and how they privilege or legitimate more mundane uses of everyday objects. In addition, these mediated congregations or groups that think of themselves both horizontally and vertically might be very useful to think with about how collective experience actually moves from one technological regime to the next. Like, where is that work being done? What kinds of aesthetics are being enlisted? What kinds of spatial proxemics are required in order to undergird our imagination that we could have a distributed collective life? And might that take us back to earlier parts of this century or further back, right? And so I want to leave then with Weber's question about the Protestant ethic and its relationship to capitalism as a social one, right? And ask that perhaps maybe there are forms of spirit that are particular or not particular to post-industrial capitalism and network society, and what might be possible to learn about the way we see ourselves together by taking seriously those kinds of social formations. So I'll leave with those questions and open the floor for discussion. Erin.
This is like the most exciting thing that's happened at the Berkman so far for me. I thank you so much for this. I'm really excited about this. So I guess my question, jumping off, would be that like these sort of large congregations often divide, or often also racial spaces, mm-hmm. like different, and I'm wondering like what you see if you've looked at like differences in sort of like the black in the church, you know, versus like this more white. I mean, assuming the Crystal Cathedral, I think, is a mostly white church.
Well, I'll show you. So,
can you talk about?
Race is a great category that is definitely not to be ignored. So, of course, they're near Disneyland, which is, you know, my segue to race there. but I mean, so there's all these like topiary creatures and like sort of illustrated biblical tales on the outside. So, you know, here is Jesus illustrated through chrome. So it's like an automobile materiality, but also a way in which the imagination is about inviting you to be reflected back in whatever skin color you have. Right? So there's a certain kind of framing the relationship perhaps to race. Garden Grove is actually next to a community that has more Vietnamese residents than anywhere else outside of Vietnam. So, and then they do have like a Hispanic congregation. It's not the most African-American place, Orange County. But there is a certain kind of change that has happened over the last 50 years. And you can see that shape in the congregation. I will say that nevertheless, when you watch the production of The Hour of Power, you know, so you see all the cameras moving around the congregation and framing shots, I would definitely say they overrepresent the diversity, right? Mm-hmm. So if you are, and also piety, so if you are looking extraordinarily enthusiastic, you're probably a more likely candidate from the studio audience. But similarly, people of color might be represented in greater numbers than they're present. This is mostly a graying congregation at this point. Let's see. So yeah, in that sense, they're different. I would, the Dutch group is also interesting because the Reformed Church has been really traditionally pretty darn Dutch. So, I mean, talk about religions left off the map in a funny way. We tell a story about the rise of evangelical media that is almost entirely about the dominance of, you know, religions post the Second Great Awakening being less denominational and liturgical and therefore being very aggressive. And they're always, you know, it's like Methodists and things like this, right? So we've told that story, and then therefore the competing stories that the old churches, the Presbyterians, you know, the Lutherans, et cetera, didn't really know what to do with this mode of social power. But the Dutch model just doesn't sort of fit all of a sudden. And in part, maybe that gestures towards an imagination about even early American religion being New England and this missing gap of like the Dutch colonies that were still speaking Dutch, you know, until the 20th century and doing this kind of work together. So there's all these little fractures and ways to pursue the story, you know, that I think race is part of, and also that create new categories of doing race and religion. Does that help? Yes.
The pictures that you had of like the drive-in theater, there was something that struck me about it that reminded me a little bit of like the tent revival era. And so I was wondering like what, if anything, you know, they thought about how they fit into, you know, the pre-1955 religious movements in America.
That's a fantastic question. So the earlier, so this is not the first time theaters get picked up for religion. The most famous cases would have been in the 1830s with Charles Finney and the Broadway Tabernacle and the Chatham Theater in New York City, where there's a new kind of Jacksonian democracy and a model of doing free church where you don't pay pew rentals. And so they would take on these theaters, and like these revivalist preachers would come out of the tents and instead have a permanent housing, always with this model of being very accessible to the public in a way. And so that is extraordinarily compelling. There's a woman who wrote a fantastic book about it called Jean Halgren Killed. And so that's a living kind of understanding. This group is a little too conservative to have regarded themselves as revivalists. Like, they're still, you know, this is like the church with like, where like you still learn about like predestination, you know, and there's like the Synod of Dort is still thrown around, you know, so this is like a very odd confluence. If anything, their story is one of it being like a necessity to learn the vernacular language. So like, you know, Paul in Athens or something like this, you know, learning, you know, whatever the local parlance is to do his letters and his preaching. And so it's never a revival model. Like, they're doing communion here, baptism, announcing new members, but it's housed in this vernacular style of the post-war. So it really puts a new split, I hope, in the story. Yeah, that's the thought. Yeah.
So I have a question about sense of spirituality amongst the congregants. Have you actually spoken to congregants?
Yeah.
Do you have, from that, have you gotten a sense of how they conceive of their own participation in this? And in particular, I'm wondering about very often spirituality in today's media space is discussed in the context of a reaction against technology. Like, everything is always ringing, you need a place to go and be safe, and you sort of seem to be contending that they're okay with moving between different functions of the technology, but are they really, like, using, are they encouraged to be tweeting while they're in service? Are there social conventions that say, you know, put your gadgets down, that's considered rude, or?
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's a great question. So it splits in two ways. For the congregants, the sense of spirituality looks a lot like you would imagine, like positive thinking. So doing personality work in order to be more available to God's communication. So Schuller's written like over 30 books. The theology is all about self-esteem and like feeling good about yourself. So that kind of wealth and prosperity gospel is definitely something that would be recognizable to these folks. So if you can just, you know, be a more creative, entrepreneurial, positive thinker, then you're doing naturally what God intended spiritual creatures to do. And so things tend to slant that way as opposed to being pro or anti-technology. That said, you'll note like the notions of technology really reify a pretty traditional structure. So if you were tweeting, for example, that would be a model of giving congregational power in a horizontal set of connections away from the pulpit. But the Jumbotron plasma screen is a way of consolidating through technology power at the pulpit. And celebrities go up there, et cetera. And so it might be useful to think about which uses of technology break certain spatial logics in order to do congregational power and which ones are actually deployed in order to maintain social order in a space like this. Because you get a sort of a range of both in the megachurch movement. Kate. Yeah.
That was great. Interesting. I can't wait to read the book. I'm curious about another technology which you didn't mention in this talk, but it seems to be very much operating in the background, which is the technology of celebrity. So Joel Osteen, you know, is a mega preacher. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the focus on him as an identity is very key to the way that people gather in these spaces. They come to see the celebrity. And if you even look at sort of the spatial orientation of the drive-in, it's all focused on the central point, and then you have the Jumbotron. But it's also the celebrity that's being broadcast through the Jumbotron that seems quite significant. Do you think about the processes of the role of the, you know, mega preacher in this book? I'd be really curious how you read that.
Yeah, I do. So, I mean, in a way, this seems like it's possibly the... There's a tragic kind of punchline. So I mentioned that the space just declared bankruptcy, and many of the leaders, which were Schuller's children, effectively, are no longer part of the group. Schuller retired in 2005, 2006, right at the turn of the year, and things have been sliding a bit since, and there are a couple stories one could tell. Right? One is definitely about a kind of failure of charisma to routinize. Yeah? So Protestant churches often have this problem of the mega, right? And yet all of this effort collectively going into building spaces that can endure and an imagination about how this will be there for their descendants hundreds of years from now, and yet it's very hard for these groups to pass the leadership down even one generation. So there's some ways of thinking about perhaps why Protestantism gets into that bubble a lot further back. So it's maybe a little ironic that the group that now will own the Crystal Cathedral is a Catholic diocese.
All right. And so the Catholics, like, if you want to know how to do, you know, franchise operations that stand the test of time, this multinational, right? It's like you look to the Catholic Church, right? So because everybody in Catholicism is literally, like, on the same page every day, anywhere you are in the world, despite all of the kind of religious syncretisms, you know? It's like that group does not do charisma. They do routine. And so there might be a way of thinking about modes of power in this case. So I'll end the book with, like, yeah, that kind of, yeah. The problems of charisma. Yeah.
What this church does in terms of missionary or outreach work and how technology plays a role in that.
So a lot of the standard things you'd imagine, you know, going to foreign countries, building houses. One of the things that's most interesting is right after the collapse of the Soviet Union, they managed to gather quite a lot of resources together to reprivatize the collective farming endeavors. So a lot of things about a kind of neoliberal imagination of restoring to people the capacity to themselves become entrepreneurs. And so even in terms of the mission work or the like local community service, there's often a model of charity built in that is about like low interest loans or, you know, ways of creating sound financial actors, you know, teaching a man to fish models of charity work. And then, you know, sort of the general things you'd expect other than that. They're not radically different than those churches in this way.
About the paradox then of that notion of kind of, you know, self-liberal action and then the focusing on the celebrity, because, you know, it blows my mind, because I grew up in the United Church of Christ, mm-hmm. which is, you know, like the Eastern merging of the Congregational Church and the Dutch Reformed Church, mm-hmm. which stayed with a decentralized model of how that church works, right? The power's in the congregation moves on, hires the pastor, etc. Totally. And so, you know, this kind of messes with my mind a little bit that there would be this movement toward a democratic model, and yet it's still consolidated in the pastor in terms of all that kind of power of the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's a strange model because it's both extraordinarily uncanny in a number of dimensions, and yet the image of its uncanniness circulates. And so the groups that pick up mostly on the spatial logic here or the celebrity logics don't tend to be Reformed church groups. It's precisely the figures you'd expect, you know, Methodists, you know, Baptists, etc. They tend to recognize this. And so in a way, this group is just, they're both odd and everywhere. And so I can't tell you, I mean, that is a paradox, I think, built in precisely here. And yet folks in Los Angeles, in a way, are exactly the people you'd have to do it with. You know, so they, for them, the celebrity model is part of the vernacular. The sense of being in a studio audience is part of how democratic participation at least functions, is, you know, it's audience, not sphere. And so those are the ways in which it's available as a reading. Yeah.
You talked about the ways in which, you know, certain kinds of framings led to certain kinds of architectural structures. I'm kind of curious about the inverse, about the ways in which these kind of technologies maybe opened up some kind of pliabilities in around dogma and beliefs. My own work on spirituality and social media, I've been seeing the ways in which ideologies around social media get incorporated with spiritual practices. And I'm wondering if you saw anything in this context, given, you know, the conservative nature of this organization.
Yeah, I mean, so some of the earlier pieces in a way are that, like having to jump the gap between cars is a way of inviting people to think across boundaries about how they're together. And if you were always together, you wouldn't need to do that thinking. But there's a productive tension between what a technology affords and a way of having to fold that back into an explanation that fits the main story. And so you get these really creative outgrowths, like the walk-in, drive-in church is a model of what happens because they're having to think across these gaps. You know, so you do get these things, and it inflects in a number of directions. The theology becomes one of presumed transparency as a way to live life appropriately, or a mode of being a channel or a conduit yourself that can achieve communication with God through the Reformed personality. You know, so these kinds of personality theories find their way in. So I think it is a certain co-production, always bounded by the strictures on both sides of what the technology can afford and the religion can accommodate. Yeah. Yes.
So when did Shuler start televising?
In 1970, they became...
So they built this church after that. And I assume that the ratio of people watching on television compared to those inside the church... swamps, right?
Yeah.
So then it seems like you should say a lot about the way the church is designed so that it'll look a certain way on television. And then lots of these icons and design choices would have different, somehow different meanings. So the Jumbotron, for example, can be more about indicating that the people inside are actually having the same experience as the people outside. The choices to make the structure look transparent mm-hmm. could be not about making the people inside feel like there's no boundary with the outside, but making the people on the outside who are contributing from a distance feel like that the organization itself is somehow transparent.
Yes.
So it seems like that should be a theme. I'm not sure if it maybe skipped over in the talk, but it seems worthwhile for the book.
Yeah, thank you very much. So I ground a lot of that story in the book in the discussion of the aesthetics of the television show. One of the aims is to take the televangelical space and parse it into a couple of variety, like sub-varieties or sub-genres. And so many of the shows you see that are religious are actually kind of variety shows. You know, so there's not really a church service. This group is traditional church service with some variety elements thrown in, but they tend to do things a lot like crossfades and dissolves, lots of panning, they use like live performers, lots of things to suggest a kind of liveness to the remote audience, and then the audience itself becomes a group that stands up and claps when a performance is good, like things you would never do in church. And so many of those decisions are in conversation with the television. So in the book, it'll go sort of Neutra's piece, how that becomes photogenic, and then how that inflects the design of the Crystal Cathedral as something which, is key. Thanks. Yes?
Going bankrupt. And that sort of leads me to the question about, call it the formal organizational structure of the church, which you didn't really, talk about. How is it actually organized? And, does that reflect sort of the same, thought processes that were reflected in spatial decisions and technology decisions?
That's a great question. So there's effectively a pretty denominationally conservative structure. There's a board for the ministry that is separate from the senior pastorship that would be in charge of the church itself. And so overturns in leadership at some level could have been only the senior pastor. Schuller was on both of these positions. And so now that the leaders of the church space have moved along, it's precisely because the board, which is composed of like elders, et cetera, that are recognizable in denominational structures, have decided that that's the right move. So that leadership is not apparent to the person on television who would totally be engaging with precisely this model of celebrity and transparency. Other than that, there's a lot of Schuller's children and their spouses now that really formed the leadership structure. So there was a point in which he was, he retired, so his son took over, and then the grandson took over the building next door to do the youth ministry. So these kinds of things are alive and well and push against this model. And in part that might be because in the broadcast world, that wasn't so unthinkable. Part of the story about networks and the sort of failure to routinize charisma is also that this model of the networked organization would have needed to supplant a broadcast model that is proto-networked, but not practically speaking the same model of organization that you would see in the early 2000s. And I think a lot of media companies suffer from that in a way. And so that never quite matched up, at least in a way that was sort of monetizable from the parent to the end. Yeah, Mike.
Great. I'm biased, but that's fantastic. That was really great. I was wondering about whether we see any sort of evidence of resistance to some of these movements that are being made, either among the congregation or among some of the leadership. So telling the story of sort of going from, the changes in the design of space, but then also the introduction of some of the newer technologies and, crowds that are tweeting or crowds that are... Do we see any sort of moments when appeals are made to a notion of authenticity or legitimacy, either among generations? So because it's been a long enough span of, I'm guessing, families that have gone to this over multiple generations, that you might start to see, people of a certain age thinking, no, how it was the authentic, and, the fact that you're tweeting through this service is somehow inauthentic or different. But is this sort of a space where we see multiple versions of authenticity coming together that we can see being worked out in either technological attitudes or modes of resistance?
Yes. So thank you. That's fantastic question. the space of the multiple forms is a moment when the organization splits. So there are different competing visions of what the organization should do theologically and what's an appropriate model of expression. And eventually, the model to move to one church means that they actually lose a huge chunk of the organizational leadership structure and, like, personal assistants, like secretaries, like lots of folks decide this is improper, right? And we're going to go do this other thing over here. And so often you see this kind of split happen when the tension builds. The space might be a way to have the split become extraordinarily visible so that a faction can consolidate. It's a little harder to get that resistance off the ground when, you know, but even now they have like multiple spaces. So they still own the Neutra building. They still own, or they owned the Johnson building, and then they did a third building by Richard Meyer, who did the Getty. So it's like big architecture on this small space. So sometimes if there's like a new, like a youth ministry, they will retreat to another building, which will then become, like they like the Neutra building, right? It's both an older model and also therefore hipper or something.
Okay.
So you see things like this used, and then there's sort of a like a group that became the online, you know, like forum and youth ministry. And so some of the work is being done by spatially parceling out resistance so that it has a space of its own. And that's an entrepreneurial endeavor to be able to formulate that space as a coherent model of mythic worldview. Yeah. It's a very spatialized mode of thinking.
Well, I really like the idea. I like your analysis of the aesthetic of the commercial, you know, with the spiritual kind of coming into all of these spaces in the architecture. And I'm curious on the business side of things, if there is a class of consultants that have emerged from like the Crystal Cathedral or the earlier iterations of the church that have gone out and, you know, kind of evangelized this aesthetic to other megachurches, to things like the Walmart, you know, shareholders meeting, etc. Is there like a community of consultants that specialize in kind of this type of experience?
Yes, and I will tell you, they're great, and there's a bunch of different ones, so I'm just like, throw out fantasy projects I wish people would do. So there is. So one of the other pieces of the book will be something about the church leadership seminars, which start in the late 1960s. So there's lots of social movement stuff going on in California. The evangelicals have their own version of this, which is bringing people together to talk about how to be a big church and why church growth equals good. So why would you need a parking lot? Why should you look like a shopping mall? Like these kinds of discussions. And a lot of the folks who become major megachurch pastors are coming to these seminars through the 1960s and 1970s. So there's this side business in this. And this group even tries things like movie and consulting operations where they will come to your church and show you how to do this. And even now, like Rick Warren, et cetera, that is the model. Right? They have materials that are franchised out to other smaller congregations about how to do church. In addition, there are these groups. I've never been to one of these meetings, but there are these amazing, like, sort of religious groups that are basically like theological trade shows on things like microphones. You know, it's like sound really matters, and those are huge markets for acoustic equipment, et cetera. And so, like, I would love to see a book about this. Bethany Morton has an interesting book called To Serve God in Walmart about evangelical groups and how they shaped the aesthetics of Walmart commercial culture in pretty sort of socially closely located ways. So that's the closest I've seen. I would love to see something like church consultants and also like the engineers at Pentecostal like services who organize the sound equipment so that people will like fall into the spirit, but themselves, like they've got to run the machines, right? So they never rest in the spirit and yet clearly have a theory of how you do technical work in order to craft spiritual condition. Like, I don't know what those people think, but I would be very curious to know, and also whether or not they're able to then monetize those skills in other sectors. A lot of the folks in this case were people working on Billy Graham campaigns, et cetera. So they did have, you know, and LA is full of people who know how to run video production that might also be Christian. So there's a lot of this kind of latent work at some level crossing worlds. Yes.
I hope I'm thinking of the right situation. I think I am. But because the Catholic diocese took over this, was it not Schuller's daughter or granddaughter who was left the board of it, and she's begun her own church? Can you say more about how that's going for her?
I don't know how it's going for her at this stage. She so Schuller has four children, four or five. Gosh, Sheila's the oldest of the children, and after, so Chula retires, passes down the ministry to his oldest son, Robert Anthony, who is trained at Fuller Theological Seminary, which seems a little too far afield and evangelical, actually, for the Reformed folks. So eventually he's asked to leave. He starts his own church. Then Sheila, the oldest child, steps in. Her husband is Jim Coleman, who's the creative director, which is really like a site of power. Like, this group is very aesthetically organized. Like, you can be buried there, and they're very proud of the typography choices. Like, everything is beautiful, you know, in a certain way. So Sheila and her husband recently left and are now starting a church. For a long time, she was the principal of the school. So she has a PhD and is very interested in education. But she's, you know, sort of the academic of the group. So it's interesting for her to take this choice to become a sort of a performative leader. She's really, you know, I mean, she'd be a recognizable figure to folks in this room, you know. The person invested in social analysis.
I feel like I read a quote from her about where her church is, mm-hmm. like that she's found this other space for it, and it's much smaller, and it's a totally different, you know, from circumstance, has had to choose a different space. It was really interesting.
Yeah, circumstance is big, right? Like, having a compelling narrative about how contemporary historical conditions and contingencies become ways of doing faith, by following where God takes you and then showing how you can repurpose that into a model of success is a big deal for Calvinism. I mean, in a way, it always sort of has been, right? To demonstrate the invisible elect through your works in the world is a pretty alive and well mode of doing religion. Yeah.
Living in Orange County, I've been hearing people talk about this on public radio quite a bit. And one of the reasons I've heard that, you know, they eventually went bankrupt was in part, you mentioned that everyone's graying, but that younger people are looking for more boutique, we might call them, congregations, and so kind of these smaller things seem to be what's vogue. I'm curious, they seem to suggest in this radio show that that means this might be like the end of the mega churches. Do you see that coming? Do you think that, I mean, what's the next step?
Okay. So, all right, so I mentioned there's this charisma routinization story. The other one might be something like, would it be useful to think about the era of the High Gothic Cathedral as a thing which is both a marker of success and a kind of periodization that is able to galvanize resistance to the aesthetics and spatial organization and therefore the formal organization of church life? So is there a way in which the Protestant Reformation project isn't intended to scale in a long-term way? I wonder if megachurches maybe will at some level break down. They're so exceptionally large versus, you know, almost all of Protestant history that there's some way in which it either has to jump to another context and where it's understandable. So like in South Korea, you get these giant mega churches that have like 20,000 people at services and things. Maybe that's a way forward for this form, but it also very much may be that there are some cultural contradictions built into this model that will inevitably move along in some kind of dialectic about, you know, coming together and breaking apart. And so one could read it in two ways. One is a kind of failure. The second might be something like, but of course, the church always finds a mode of being appropriate to its historical conditions. Mm-hmm. And if those are a notion of small, distributed, etc., do we regard that as a failure or the natural process of reformation? Mm-hmm. If you're a believer, maybe the latter. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is there a functioning Catholic parish in the Crystal Cathedral building there?
There will be. They've just started putting it together, but there will be a functioning group. The space is very well suited to Catholicism because of the hybrid sort of postmodern form. It's just, you know, you could just imagine putting the Stations of the Cross mm-hmm. around that boundary, and it would already be set up in an appropriate manner. It's got the, you know, the narthex, and it's got the apses and the galleries.
Do they expect to have that much of a critical mass from the start amongst Catholic congregates, like the other? Because one of the things I'm kind of interested in is how these buildings get repurposed, you know, mm-hmm. in the broad span of time. And in cities like New York, maybe even Boston, old churches are typically turned into really nice condos now. So I'm wondering, like, when the time comes for these things to fall, in a sense, what's going to happen to these spaces. And, you know, congregational repurposing is interesting, but are they going to have that many people there to start?
I don't know. I mean, it's I guess it remains to be seen. I mean, Orange County's got a pretty, you know, large immigrant population, so there's certainly perhaps an underserved group in the area. They had a pretty good Hispanic ministry, so perhaps that will fill some of the space, but I don't know is the answer. Yeah.
I'm curious about your source space. Were you able to get access to church archives?
Or yes.
They were, because I mean, mega churches are sometimes quite wary of too much scrutiny, and I just wondered what your relationship with the congregation ended up looking like.
They're, you know, they try to be transparent in a way. Like, so they actually have a very good archive that has been very underutilized. And one of the really exciting things about the archive is because they were on television, you can see how people were using space, at least get some indication from multiple decades. And so it's nice to have those kinds of materials on hand. There's a guy called Bruce Hollenbeck, who's the archivist there, who was originally the bodyguard and head of security, but his real passion was archival work. You know, God bless him. So he, he trained himself as an autodidact. He trained himself to become an archivist and started putting together this massive corpus of things. And so I was sort of the first person who'd come and said, can I see stuff? Like, there was, you know, occasionally a picture here or there will appear, but the space has been seen as really like bad Neutra and Johnson architecture. So architectural historians haven't been particularly enthusiastic about combing the space. So they actually have a lot of material and a lot of like unprocessed letters and things like this. And so they were, you know, I think they're willing to see themselves as something which is desirable as a historical object to secular communities as well. Yeah, I think so. I think they do. They talk a lot about this space as on par or exceeding like Chartres and Notre Dame, you know, the kind of church that is in that tradition and yet only possible with space frame engineering and television. So it's totally intended to be read as that kind of endeavor. They've worked very hard to try to endow the space. There's time capsules underneath the walkways so that you can think about what, you know, what church will be like in 400 years. So since I have a few minutes, it's really exciting, I would like to ask, are there things that I should be thinking about? There's a very extraordinarily legal and policy-oriented group in this room in particular. Are there questions that I should be asking that I'm clearly not? Like, the ink ain't dry, so feedback is really helpful at this stage. Yes?
I enjoy a lot of the presentation. I am amazed. I don't know if it's something that you don't know, you don't do, but because I look from the perspective of sociological organization of things, not the architecture on that, I would be more interested of listening more about if technology has changed also relationships, or because I analyzed how in social movements the introduction or the adoption of technology has changed the organizational logic from more hierarchical groups to more network-oriented horizontal groups. So I would be very interested to look from that perspective.
Thanks. Yeah. I mean, the story is slightly moves into the networked world. You know, it sort of just pins that shift. But I think one of the things I want to make sure to do for sure is think about how this group would compare to social movements that are clearly running through this as a competing narrative for how you do collectives. Mm-hmm. So that's helpful to hear that thread could be brought up to more visibility.
I don't know if you should do it, but if it's your job or not. But I think this your work is like a metaphor or an example of what can happen in the world of education if we go virtual and all this huge or tinier and into different modalities, what happens with a community and with it, because everything you said is very interesting, but the sad part is that the next generation won't take it. Religion and education is passing on a tradition. Mm-hmm. And if you cannot pass this on, then you failed. And they are not wanting to receive it. Mm-hmm. And something, I think this exercise is interesting to to think of what's happening now and what could happen, you know, in, if we change our settings of learning and transmitting too much or too big or too little or too virtual or all the things that they have experimented with in very creative ways. And surely not intending that one day this would even be sent to, given or passed on to another congregation with different ideals and things. So it's I think it's very important work.
Well,
congratulations.
Thanks. Yeah. I want to keep, I think the education theme is apparent. So I started doing this work because I was really interested in the screens, you know, and how they affect rooms full of people. And I was thinking in particular about education settings. So, I mean, this is a pretty interesting example, right? We've decided to be in a round at some level together, but we keep doing this thing in educational spaces where we effectively build like a front of the room and a model of authority that's inscribed into the logic of the architecture, despite the fact that we keep making the room smarter. We sort of replicate a very parochial logic of how information transmits. And I'm wondering if there's a way to think simultaneously about the transmission of an orientation towards, let's say, knowledge or learning, and therefore to make the formal qualities of the architecture echo or extend this model, so that at least if we want to transmit a kind of way of being a civic society and having education perform in certain senses, we get some alignment rather than create multiple messages that pull against each other about how to be together.
Yeah. At the very beginning of your talk, you talked about the sports arena.
Yeah.
And in a sense, when you ask something to think about, I was thinking, oh, you know, what is happening with baseball? What is the practice of going to baseball games in, you know, in Boston? And there's this culture that people, you know, go to pubs and they go with friends. In other words, I wonder whether more of a focus on the audience and the way that the audience organizes it according to their interests and their practices. Do I go with friends and tweet and say, you know, meet you, you know, here? And what happens before and after the event? Because I think that this whole notion of, you know, like the consultants, like I was thinking, you know, it sounded to me like what is happening in the wine industry, right? You had these very situated, like, production of wine that was derivative of what the earth provided. And then now you have the California vineyard sort of with this sort of global standards of, you know, values and things like that. So there's all these things going on at the same time, but I think that the audience and the practices and preferences and the sort of habitus of the audience can give you a lot of ideas about where that might move generationally and, you know, in social space and historical space.
Thank you.
I just want to highlight last question because we're getting close to time.
I'd be really curious to see an analysis of how the service was constructed over all of these changes. Like, how did it iterate? You mentioned the speaker boxes coming in and being mentioned at, you know, like the benediction and the prelude. And I'm curious if you can see iterations in how they structured the service based on each set of new technologies that came in, the way that the building was constructed, the type of, you know, service that was in there. And then, of course, television. And how they iterated over the way the service was conducted and what parts were important and what parts were left out, et cetera, through time.
Okay, I assume they don't take commercial breaks in the middle of the service, but...
No. They don't. But they do have offerings built in where the, you know, there's an audience moment, then it will cut to, like, your home offering. So it's an inbuilt commercial at a certain level. Which would be kind of new. The language changes, right? It becomes more gender neutral over time. The Jumbotron plasma screen is one of my favorite changes. When I asked, like, well, you know, why did you put this in here? At some level, it could have just been like, oh, well, we always wanted it at the drive-in, but, you know, whatever. The best answer I got was from someone who was the music director at the time, and he said, let me think about this. He said, oh, it's because filming a bunch of people looking down, reading when they sing, just doesn't look good. You know, and so having everybody's face turned up towards a light source that beams back at them looks more pious. And that package of shift of the glowing upturned face is then, you know, being picked up as what Protestantism looks like to very remote audiences who have, like, you know, very little experience with American religion as what it is like to worship. So these kinds of things, maybe, you know, I'll try to spend some time, you know, ruminating with through these iterations.
We're about
drive and expected to bring their own hymnals and Bibles with them at all?
They tended to bring them with them, but then they very early started, like when you'd go through the ticket counter, that would be where the ushers normally are. There would be the like these like, you know, physical paper little booklets with the notes about the sermon and the announcements. And then they would copy out pieces of scripture, et cetera, so that you don't need that. And they would refer instead to the sermon as like the morning's message. You know, so there's this subtle shift in how to explicate what the Reformed liturgy even is. And so the assumption is people just probably don't even know. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.